The incarnation is truly an amazing thing. So grab your bulletin real quick and let me just read the back of that bulletin because, well, maybe could be said better. It does communicate the essence of our time here today. The importance of the incarnation truly cannot be overstated. For the incarnation directly relates to salvation. Without the incarnation, there would be no salvation. See, man has a fundamental problem. And that fundamental problem is the gap that we have between God. God is absolutely, fundamentally holy. And I, and probably to you on some bad days, are anything but holy. And the gap is real, and the gap is irreparable. There is nothing a human being can do to repair the damage, to bridge the gap between a holy God and an unholy individual. So what we got then is if there's going to be some sort of fellowship, if there's going to be some form of reconciliation, we need a redeemer. We need help. And this opportunity to be reconciled to God has been accomplished through the incarnation in which deity and humanity were united in an individual. This individual, Jesus Christ, God the Son, was someone who was truly 100% God, while at the same time he was truly 100% human. And yes, that does seem difficult to fully understand. And we're going to talk about that just a little bit. Well, let's go back to the reason for the incarnation. The reason. We needed a God-man. Because if Jesus is not really a man, then humanity has not been given an opportunity for salvation. And we cannot be saved from the penalty of our sins. Because as the Bible teaches in Romans 3 and others, that the wages of sin is death. The soul that sinneth, it shall... We're in a world of hurt, man. And as we get older, especially those of us who get older, we just continually accumulate more and more sin debt to God. Or said in other words, IOUs. This book is full of things that we must do. There's no option. This book of things is full of things that we must not do. And every time we violate them, it's like, oh, we owe you that, God. Oh, we owe you that, God. And how we pay for that, unfortunately, is an eternal destiny in hell. So someone had to come and pay that price for us. Someone needed to literally deliver us from the penalty or the accumulation of our sins. And we needed someone who was human as a representative of humanity, but it just couldn't be a good guy. It just couldn't be a moral teacher. There had to be someone who was perfect. Because as soon as Jesus Christ, if he ever committed a sin, then he's no better than any of the rest of us. So we needed someone who was truly human and truly God to put into one body. And simply said, without such, we could not be paid. But there's also another reason for the incarnation. You know, as we've been studying the attributes of God on Wednesday night, you know, God has complete knowledge. He knows everything. He knows everything in the past from long before Genesis 1:1. He knows everything that's going to happen in eternity for ages and ages to come. He knows everything that happens, actually, everything that could happen, all the possibilities, and he knows them instantaneously and completely. But we're not so sure about that. So when it comes to the intercessory ministry that God has for us, when he's our helper, when he's our intercessor, when he's pleading on the right hand of Jesus Christ, when we go to our prayers and God, God did not need to go through all the struggles of humanity for his benefit, but he went through all the struggles of humanity for our benefit. so that we would have greater confidence in one who literally, to use an expression, who has walked a mile in our shoes. So those are briefly just some of the reasons for that incarnation, although the primary one, our need of a Redeemer, a need of a substitute, cannot be overstated. But then there's confusion of the incarnation, and maybe some of you are there, and as we really begin to ponder it, it does become a little perplexing. Because what was it? Was he fully God or was he fully man? You know, and then, Pastor, I thought you said just a little bit ago that God was a spirit. Well, what is this fleshly thing then? And it has brought much consternation to the people through many years. Was he deity? Was he humanity? Which was it? And let me just give you just a couple brief wrong ideas. Because what happens in our minds, humanity, is we try to organize and make everything fit. But last Wednesday night, those of you who are here, anyone remember what the topic was? Started with the letter I. God is what? Incomprehensible. God cannot be fully, totally understood. Now, we can know him. Otherwise, what's the purpose of our being here today? But it's not always going to fit. It's not always going to get inside our little logical box. So mankind has tried to come up with some way to put God in a box and make him understandable. And one of the false explanations was that when God came into Mary's womb at that moment of conception, the Logos, as John would say, or the deity of God, actually took over the humanity, absorbed it, and he basically was just a divine being. There was no humanity, and there's a certain group of people that for millenniums have been saying that he was not a man, he just was truly God. Then you have another explanation that has been going on, and this is the newer word, but Jesus was the classic dissociative identity disorder. Or sometimes we would call it like the classic, you know, schizophrenic, that there's this two people fighting, urging to get out somehow, and there were two individuals inside a singular entity. And that these two independent people lived different, separate lives. Which, that's a false explanation. And then there was another explanation that basically has the idea that Jesus Christ formed a third nature. So you have the divine nature, you have the human nature, and they combine and they form a hybrid, which then again makes them neither completely human or completely divine. So let me read you a statement that was written in AD 541. And here a bunch of men got together, and they needed to respond to these false ideas. And then the other false idea that I think I said was that Jesus wasn't really divine at all. Many times we hear people say, oh, he was a good teacher, he was a prophet, but they don't attribute deity to him. Well, here's a statement that goes way back to 1,500 and some years ago. It says this, that Jesus Christ, only begotten, recognized in two natures, without confusion, without change, without division, without separation. And the distinctions of the two natures were no way annulled by the union. I'll explain in just a second. But rather, the characteristics of each nature being preserved and coming together to form one person. So what was he? Was he man or was he God? And the answer is yes. He was. He was fully 100% God. And he was fully 100% man. Yeah, but that doesn't make sense. And maybe in a way it doesn't. But there's a lot of things in my little world that doesn't make sense that I still, you know, believe and trust. One of them being this here, oftentimes don't make sense to me and just how all that works. I'm not much of a computer geek, and though my boy is, and he tells me over the phone, oh, you just got to do this, this, this. I go, whoa, Eric, whoa, slow down here. Let's start with number one. Number two. But he's, you know, he's the computer geek. I don't quite fully understand all of this, but I still use it, and I still believe it, and I still trust it. So, and it's the same thing with this idea of God. Was he fully human? Yes. Was he fully God? Yes. Well, how can that be? Well, we got a God that is bigger than what we could ever think of. So don't try to reduce him into your box. But let's go to something that's more profound and significant. Go to Philippians chapter 2, and let's look at verses 6 and 8. Because I want you to spend just a few moments thinking about the nature of this incarnation. In Philippians chapter 2, verse 6, it says, being in the form of God. That has the idea of the nature of God. It's the inner essence. Jesus Christ is the very essence or the morphe of God. He's what Paul is doing here in Philippians 2, 6, is he's saying very clearly, unequivocally, so no one could have any doubts that this is God. He is in the essence or the form of God. And then as you go on a little bit further, at the end of that verse it says, to be equal with God. Equal in essence, equal in equality. He is in fact fully God. Now let me just quickly run through just some instances from the Bible that prove that Jesus is God, and I'll read you the reference. You won't have time to write it down. Email me and I will give you the references. But Jesus never changes, according to Hebrews 13. Jesus is all powerful, according to Matthew 28. We looked at that briefly in the morning hour earlier. Jesus knows all things in John chapter 2. When he is starting his ministry after John the Baptist, what happened? The heavens opened up. We see this dove coming down and we hear this voice, this tremendous voice says, this is my beloved son and who I am well pleased. Hear ye him. Divine acknowledgement that this is just not a mere mortal. This is my son, my only begotten. Jesus raised the dead back to life. Don't have many people doing that today. We have Jesus himself being resurrected after being dead for 3 days. And then the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are just replete. They're full. They're jam-packed with all the miracles of how many blind men or women saw again. How many deaf heard. How many lame walked. How many people did he feed? How many storms did he calm? Over and over and over again, it comes to Nicodemus there in John chapter 3. At the beginning of it, Nicodemus says, we know you're of God. Nobody has done the miracles that we've seen you do. Kind of the Scogan spin on that verse, by the way. Not exactly accurate. But here's something that's amazing. And I want you to see the nature of this incarnation. Because though he possesses full deity, he did not consider the equality with God, Philippians 2, 6, as something to be held on to. And that's that idea of robbery. The robbery is the grasping or the seizing, the not relinquishing it. It's like maybe you're taking your child to the checkout in the grocery store and they've got all the candy right there at the checkout. And your little toddler, and let's put him in the cart up there in the seat, he grabs it and he's holding on to it and you say, now give it to me. And he basically says, not by the hair of my chin, chin, chin. And he's got that. He's not going to relinquish it. It's the robbery. He has grasped it. He has seized it, and he's not going to let it go. And that's what this Philippians 2:6 is saying. Although I don't know if that's exactly the same word picture, but it gets the point across. Basically, what he's saying there in Philippians 2:6 is Christ did not hesitate to impose upon himself limitations on the use of his deity in daily life. As the God of all rights, because again, we live in a world of rights, don't we? You need to respect me. Don't disrespect me and all that mentality. And rights and entitlements and reparations and all that kind of stuff. But here's the God who had absolute claim to all rights. He is God, the Son. And yet, he relinquishes those rights. He lets them go. He releases himself. He puts limitations on himself. As I mentioned earlier, God is omnipresent. He's everywhere present at all times in his totality. And yet, when he was born, he was willing to set aside. By the way, there's another fancy word for these passages here, 2, 6 through 8, is the kenosis, the emptying of himself. And he limited himself willingly to be in one place at one time. As I mentioned, God is always perfect, which means he lacks nothing. He falls short to nothing. And yet God the incarnate was born a baby. And I'm not seeing many babies get up and walk and talk and run and play the piano. So he limited himself, a God who was perfect in all the, and let's just go with the gross and fine motor skills. You know, they have basically no gross motor skills and fine motor skills. That don't happen until years later. And God the Son, who was perfect, was willing to endure that whole process. As Luke 2:52 says, grow in wisdom and in stature. That's physical aspect of it. God the Son was dependent upon someone to feed him. The nature of this incarnation. He's also found in the likeness of man. Look at verses 7 and 8. But made himself of no reputation, taking on the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of a man, the bottom of verse 7, the beginning of verse 8, and being found in appearance as a man. This proves he was human. You know, he had a human mother, the Virgin Mary. He did not have a human father, by the way. Anybody think of why he couldn't have a human father? How's the sin nature passed down from generation to generation? Adam. So unfortunately, while there's been times when our kids were growing up, I'd look at Robin and say, hey, he came from your womb. You know, as we try to say, but then she would come back, yeah, but you're the one who gave him that sin nature. So that's why he could not have a human father. Jesus did have a body that grew and developed. When you guys have your nativity set up, are you going to have a full-grown body in that cradle or whatever it is, manger? Put a little baby. So he had a body that grew and developed because they didn't nail a baby to a cross. He was human. He looked like a man. In John 4:9, Jesus got hungry. He got tired. He was thirsty. He bled. He died. He was human. He was 100% divine, and that we saw the miracles that he's done. He's 100% human, and that he was hungry. He slept. He awoke. He bled. He died. And they merged together. The outworking of this incarnation is again found in verses 7 and 8. While fully God and fully man, and this again baffles my mind, because you know, if you're going to go somewhere, and you could take any title, any position, any rank you want, who wants to take the bottom rung of the ladder? You know, it's like, hey, you're going to Argentina. So we ask Bill, or we could ask his wife Karen, and we could ask B. Kirby, how do you want us to portray you, and what rank or position do you want here in Argentina? Oh, I want to be top dog. I want to have all the whiskers of seniority here. You know, I want to be the somebody. But how did Jesus come? As you see there in verse 7, he made himself of no reputation, taking on the form of a bondservant, a slave, a willing slave. Again, in Jewish culture, you serve your 7 years, and at the year of Jubilee, you could be released from slavery, or if you wanted to continue in that master service, you'd have your hole pierced in your ear, and then you were a willing slave to that man until you died. You were a bond slave. And that's the form that Jesus Christ came in. He didn't take on that of a priest, because you think that would make sense, wouldn't you? Well, okay, maybe not a priest. Maybe it was just going to be like the church worker, to be the Levite, you know, the one to clean and make sure everything is properly prepared and supplied. He didn't come as a Levite. How about a high priest? Because he was a high priest, as Hebrews teach us. He is the great high priest. No, he didn't want that either. Okay, well, let's set religion aside for a minute. Why don't you come as a governor? Why don't you come as an emperor? Why don't you truly come as King of Kings, as you are? But he let all that go. And he came in the form of a bond servant. And again, the picture in my mind races to the Last Supper, where Jesus is washing the feet of the disciples. And all 12 of them were there at that time. So he's washing the disciples' feet, being Judas and Peter, doubting Thomas. I mean, he hasn't doubted yet. But he's doing all of that. And as you and I know, as we look at some of the biblical culture of that day, you know, like in anything, there was a ranking. There was a seniority going on. And only the one, the servant that had the lowest seniority or the newest member of that household got to sit down and wash some stinking feet. Because you and I could imagine it, if we were to take off our shoes now, my shoes have been on now for 5 hours, it would be, he stinketh. So you don't want to be washing my feet, and just as I'm sure you wouldn't want to be washing other people's feet. Well, that was just a filthy job because they didn't necessarily have the storm sewers and the gutters and everything like we had, and they were just walking where cattle and everything else walked in sandals. It was just a filthy task. And the bottom of the servant does that. The least ranking member does it. But Jesus is doing that, and it's just mind-boggling. It's just hard to understand. The outworking of it. He does that. But you know what? He then gives up his rights, as I mentioned earlier. The one who should have come to be served is now the one who is serving. And again, this is where, you know, we've talked once or twice before. You've heard that you and I need to be a part of the movement of fundamental, radical nonconformity. And this is one mindset that you and I need to embrace, that goes against the very core of our society. And the society is, don't disrespect me. You need to respect me. Don't whatever me, and I deserve this, and this is my right. You know, I'm an American. I'm a tax-paying citizen. I deserve this. And what does Jesus have? He gives it up. He gives it up. He lets it go. It's not a thing to be grasped. Instead of being served, he serves. And that's just with us. It's so ingrained in our mindset. And in the Christian community, you and I, we must embrace this as a way of life. Defer our rights. Minister to others. Serve others. Agapao. Right? That sacrificial, selfless love for the benefit of someone else. That Greek word, agape. He became the doulos. He became the doulos. Then look at verses 7 and 8 again a little bit more. Being a servant, he humbled himself. And this is kind of interesting because it's a reflective pronoun. He humbled himself. There's an act of the will. This just doesn't happen automatically. And we certainly don't like it when someone tries to humble us. Now, that's not a pleasant experience. But Jesus Christ willingly humbled himself. You know, it's kind of interesting. Look up again here a little bit. When he said, consider it, verse 6, consider it. That is kind of like an old-fashioned accounting term of reckoning. You add up all the Excel columns and you end up with the bottom figure at it. Or you take the old-fashioned spreadsheet or whatever you're using. You add up all the columns and you add it all up. You work through each item and at the bottom of it is your total. Jesus Christ reckoned this. This idea of coming down as a man and taking on the form of a servant and humbling himself to death was not something he did capriciously or whimsically. He thought it through. There was a price to be paid, and he was full aware of what it was going to cost him to do this. As well, he was full aware of to whom he was going to do it for. And that's just, that's points to ponder later on. Here's the takeaway. Here's just quickly some practical applications that are on the bottom of that back panel of your bulletin. You know, if we're going to be followers of Jesus Christ, if we're going to be Christ-like ones, if we're going to be Christians, and if we're also going to embrace the mandate of Philippians 2, 3, and 4, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but each one of us, in the lowliness of our mind, or to esteem others better than ourselves. If we're not only going to follow the example of Jesus Christ, but to obey what the Bible tells us to, then we're going to have to refuse to exploit our position. I am the head of the house. And sometimes I've heard people use profanity in it where they say, bless God, I am the head of the house, and you will do as I say, when I say, and how I say. Really? Where does that fit in Philippians 2, 3, and 4? Where does that fit in Philippians 2, 6 through 8? It ought to be like this. I am the husband. I'm the head of the house. So, honey, you got the day off. I'm doing the cleaning for you today. I'm taking care of the kids today. I'm going shopping for you. You know what? You need just to sit back and relax. In fact, here. Here's the remote. You know what? Sunday afternoon, I don't need to watch the game. Here, you watch your Hallmark or cooking channel. But I'm the head of the house. But I will defer my rights. And instead of sitting back with my little brass bell saying, I'll have a cup of tea, please. Honey, can you change the channel? Honey, the dog needs to be let out. Honey, the kids are crying. Do something about it. We throw the stupid bell away and we do like Christ did and we serve. But see, that's radical, fundamental nonconformity. That's not what goes on outside this wall. So we're going to have to do that. We're going to have to defer our rights for the benefit of others. We're going to have to maintain a mindset of humility and that of being a bond slave. I'm a bond slave. No one beat me into this. No one's holding a gun to my head. I am a willing bond slave. I've willingly given my life to serve my master till I die. So, how about it? The incarnation. It's an amazing concept. It is truly an amazing concept. And I want to encourage you to go home and study it. Now be careful on the internet. You know, there's a lot of good stuff. There's a lot of bad stuff on there too. But I'd go ahead and encourage you to go home and continue to wrestle with this idea of the incarnation. And then the kenosis. The emptying of himself, the humbling of himself, the limiting of himself. But while that's kind of a nice academic environment, a building of our faith, then the application comes to so what? So if Christ did this for us, what are we willing to do for others around us? What are we willing to do for those in our sphere of influence? And then just one more series of questions, and that is that, what have you personally done with the opportunity that this incarnation represents? It is through this incarnation that you can be reconciled to God. It is through this incarnation that allows you your sin debt to be paid. It allows you to escape hell and to go into heaven for eternity. Have you received this gift of salvation? Have you been reconciled to God by the death, the burial, and the resurrection of the incarnate God the Son, Jesus Christ? Heads bowed, eyes are closed. Just take a moment to reflect on our message here today.